Hello and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and also alexlinder.com. Today we're going to do chapter 29 from The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History by E. Michael Jones, published 2008. Look for him at culturewars.com. This chapter is called The Black Panthers. Let's look at the end notes here. It's a chapter of modest length, maybe 20 pages, slightly under average. A lot of endnotes are from Horowitz's book, David Horowitz, Radical Son, A Journey Through Our Times. That's from 1997. Yeah, that's most of, about half, no. Single greatest source for the entire chapter. Then Ronald Radosh, who we've heard from before, in these endnotes, Commies, A Journey Through the Old Left, the New Left, and the Leftover Left, from 2001. Again, he's a affiliate of Horowitz, Front Page Magazine, Front Page Mag, that we used to write about back in 2000. Dan T. Carter, Scottsboro, A Tragedy of the American South. Tom Wolfe, Radical Chic, and Mau Mauing the Flat Catchers, early 70s book, actually 1970. David Horowitz, Hating Whitey and Other Progressive Causes, from 1999. Notice the Whitey, the diminutive. I always point out so that even when this guy is, to the delight of the simps who are the biological stratum that is the market, the professional conservatives serve, denounces leftist attacks on whites, he still uses the diminutive Whitey to be, yeah, you shouldn't be attacked, but you also shouldn't take yourself seriously. And that will close out those end notes. Now let's turn to the text itself. And this begins on, as I said, 949. It's about, let's see, yeah, up to 969, but most of the last two are blank. Or 970, actually, 70 and 69 are blank. So, yeah, about 18 pages. Chapter 29, The Black Panthers. On October 15, 1966, when Martin Luther King's failure to reform the housing situation in Chicago had become painfully apparent, three Negroes who were on the payroll of an anti-poverty program in Oakland, California, sat down and created a new revolutionary organization known as the Black Panther Party. October 15, 1966. As one of their first acts, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, two of the three co-founders, persuaded a Japanese-American by the name of Richard Aoki to give them his M1 rifle and his 9mm pistol because, they reasoned, real revolutionaries need guns. Huey Newton, one of the three founding members of the Black Panthers, was born in Louisiana and named after that state's most famous governor. His parents came to Oakland during the job boom of World War II, when that city was a major entrepot for the Pacific Theater. Newton may have gotten his first guns from a Japanese-American revolutionary, but he got the idea to turn his shakedown operation into a revolutionary organization from the Jews he met at Merritt College. Quote, "Nothing made the idea of revolution more vivid to the white left, as Todd Gitlin put it in his History of the 60s, than the Black Panther Party. Unlike the Black Nationalists, David Horowitz tells us, the Panthers quoted Marx and actively sought alliances with the white left. Horowitz doesn't say so explicitly at this point, at least, but the so-called white left in the Bay Area and elsewhere was overwhelmingly Jewish. The saga of the rise and the fall of the Black Panthers was the same old black-Jewish alliance story in a new, more violent, overtly revolutionary key. The Black Panthers were attracted to the Jews for all the usual reasons. The Jews were experienced revolutionaries who knew how to run organizations and raise money, or in the case of Bert Schneider, the Hollywood producer who bankrolled the Panthers, given in large quantities as well. The Jews were attracted to the Panthers, although no one would say so publicly, because of their willingness to use violence to bring about revolution. Horowitz claims that, quote, it was the Panthers' violent image that provided the real attraction to the new left. The Panthers had been inspired by the Jews in other ways as well. As part of their 10-point program, the Panthers demanded reparations payments for American blacks because the Jews had been so successful in shaking down money from the Germans after World War II. Quote, "The Germans are now aiding the Jews in Israel for the genocide of the Jewish people. The Germans murdered 6 million Jews. The American racist has taken a part in the slaughter of over 50 million black people. Therefore, we feel that this is a modest demand that we make." In May 1966, Stokely Carmichael became chairman of the SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. As one of his first acts, he expelled the Jews from the civil rights movement. David Horowitz remembers being stunned by the magnitude of the betrayal. Quote, "Jews had funded the movement, devised its legal strategies, and provided support for its efforts in the media and in the universities and wherever else they had power. More than half the freedom riders who had gone to the southern states were Jews, although Jews constituted only 3% of the population. It was an unprecedented show of solidarity from one people to another. Jews had put their resources and lives on the line to support the black struggle for civil rights, and indeed two of their sons, Schwerner and Goodman, had been murdered for their efforts." Actually, Jews did it to serve themselves, but see, even the right-wing Jew hides that, as though Jews are selfless rather than selfish. But even while those tragic events were still fresh, the black leaders of the movement had unceremoniously expelled the Jews from their ranks. Horowitz could not understand how blacks could treat Jews like this, especially, quote, "since Jews were a near majority of the whites in these organizations and had played a strategic role in organizing and funding the struggle. The Jews, who had spent roughly 60 years trying to turn the Negro masses into the avant-garde of revolutionary change in America, woke up in the mid-60s to discover that Tom Watson had been right all along, the Georgian. Like Frankenstein, they had created a monster that was no longer under their control. Now that the revolution was breaking out in black ghettos across the country, the revolution looked as if it were going to devour its own Jews. As a result, the Jews who had poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into the civil rights movement tried to use moderates like Martin Luther King to get back at ungrateful Schwarzes like Stokely Carmichael. On July 25, 1966, Martin Luther King attacked black power in a paid ad in the New York Times. King's statement had been written by Stanley Levison. Friedman is quick to add that Levison, of course, was only putting into words what King himself felt, quote, "without understanding how this admission lent credence to the SNCC's claim that Martin Luther King had become a Jewish puppet." SNCC, which John Lewis described as part domestic peace corps and part guerrilla warfare, was the cutting-edge Negro revolutionary organization at the time. But since the SNCC was not interested in talking to white people anymore, Jewish alumni of the Freedom Summer in Mississippi, like Bay Area lawyer Faye Stender, gravitated into the orbit of the Black Panthers. Faye Stender was one of the many Jewish lawyers who were involved in interracial romances with her black clients. The big impetus for the sexual phase of the Black Jewish Alliance was the Freedom Summer of 1964 in Mississippi, an experience which some participants say led to, one, feminism among the Jewish women, and two, the expulsion of whites from the movement because black women had become outraged at the seduction of what they considered their men. Asked for his thoughts on the position of women in the movement in 1964, SNCC Chairman Stokely Carmichael replied, "prone." Eldridge Cleaver had been released from prison in December 1966, largely because of the efforts of Beverly Axelrod, his mistress-cum-attorney, and because of the articles he had written in Rampart's magazine. It's Horowitz's magazine. After his release from prison, when Cleaver set himself up in a large Victorian house on Pine Street in San Francisco's predominantly black Fillmore district, it was Axelrod who raised the money from various communist organizations to pay Cleaver's bills. Using the Black House as his base of operations, Cleaver planned to launch New Black Political Movement, which would take up the banner that Malcolm X had let drop when he was assassinated. That meant collaborating with Betty Shabazz, Malcolm X's widow, who was invited to the Bay Area for a memorial service and negotiations. When Malcolm X's widow, Betty Shabazz, arrived at Rampart's offices for an interview, a confrontation with the police ensued. When the police ordered the Panthers to put away their weapons, Huey Newton leveled his shotgun at the officer in charge, who promptly backed down. Eldridge Cleaver was impressed. "God damn," Cleaver said of Newton, "that nigger is crazy." Newton's bravado so impressed Cleaver that he dropped the idea of forming his own organization and joined the Black Panthers, which promptly appointed him their Minister of Information. Eldridge Cleaver later wrote an article for Ramparts called, quote, "How I Fell in Love with the Black Panther Party," describing the confrontation as the moment of truth that won his allegiance. In an intro for a planned Newton biography, he characterized Huey as the baddest motherfucker ever to set foot inside of history. The line, however, was not written by Eldridge Cleaver, but by a white Ramparts editor named Peter Collier, who was a goy who worked with Horowitz. It's funny. Right, when I first started getting back to politics, I actually spoke to Peter Collier as I was trying to place. I had written some stuff I thought was very funny and sent it to them to try to get it published. That was still before the internet, and I spoke to Collier. But again, an old goy who became Horowitz's partner. It was the first of many instances when a white revolutionary would put words in Cleaver's mouth. One of the things Newton and Cleaver had in common was their acquaintance with a revolutionary Jew by the name of Robert Scheer. Huey Newton had already met Scheer at Merritt College. By the time Newton faced down the Oakland police at Rampart's offices, Scheer had already made contact with Eldridge Cleaver, who was serving time in Soledad prison and had published an article by him in the Ramparts in June 1966. Robert Scheer was a writer who had a small political... You know, I knew, I used to room with this kid when we were both in D.C. working in a place who knew Scheer's son, who went off to, pretty sure I've got the right guy, went off to Czechoslovakia right after they had the revolution and had started some English paper out there, as I recall. Used to be a big thing. Robert Scheer was a writer who had a small political following at his disposal as the result of an unsuccessful campaign to unseat Congressman Jeffrey Coelan. I'm guessing at the pronunciation of that. Never seen it before. C-O-H-E-L-A-N. Scheer would go on to write a column for the Los Angeles Times and conduct the famous Jimmy Carter interview, which appeared in Playboy in the late 1970s. I think where he admitted to having lust in his heart or something. But he began his journalist career as editor of Root and Branch, the journal that created the New Left at Berkeley. By the second issue of Root and Branch, Scheer had defined the style of the New Left. It was going to be a fusion of Marxist agendas with the anarchic spirit of American mischief. Once they defined the style of both the counterculture, quote-unquote, and the youth rebellion, quote-unquote, revolutionary Jews like Scheer and Horowitz could once again assume their positions at the forefront of the movement and become the self-conscious vanguard of a social revolution. Ironically, Horowitz submitted a critique of contraception as a part of one of his Root and Branch articles, but the idea was shot down by Scheer, who dismissed any misgivings about contraception as, quote, a point of view so perverse that only a reactionary and probably only a Catholic could hold it. In addition to their work at Root and Branch, both Horowitz and Scheer wrote seminal books that also helped create the New Left of the 1960s. Horowitz dedicated his book Student to Justice Hugo Black, half of the radical Black Douglas faction on the Supreme Court that was busy ratifying the New Left's turn away from economics and toward sexual issues as the cutting edge of revolution. Scheer's book was on Vietnam. In fact, Scheer joined the staff of Ramparts magazine after the publication of How the United States Got Involved in Vietnam, a book the nation called the most important analysis of the war up to that time. Once he joined the staff of Ramparts, Scheer took erstwhile Catholic magazine in an Scheer took the erstwhile the former Catholic magazine in an increasingly revolutionary direction, largely because he brought a whole cadre of revolutionary Jews on board. In the fall of 1967, David Horowitz joined Scheer on the staff of Ramparts to run its book publishing division. Horowitz had been a member of the NAACP at Columbia, where, like other radicals, he followed the progress of the Montgomery bus boycott and the early sit-ins. Horowitz, quote, was pleased when my mother indicated in a conspiratorial tone that Rosa Parks was one of us, but doesn't explain whether us meant being Jewish or being a revolutionary. That's because the two terms were synonymous for Horowitz when he was growing up. Real ethnicity was bad. Revolution was Horowitz's ethnicity. His parents were red diaper communists. Or he was a red diaper baby. His parents were old left communists. It was Cudahy's thesis, right? Remember, John Murray Cudahy, My Personal Awakening, Complete, or Deepening is how I would put it. It was Cudahy's thesis that the revolutionary ideas of Marx and Freud were attempts to deconstruct these civil orders and replace them with a universal one in which they would finally be granted the acceptance they craved. Thus, Freud claimed to show that bourgeois civility was a mask for sexual repression, while Marx argued that it mystified economic exploitation. Each had a vision of liberation that would provide a universal solvent in which the significance of ethnic identities disappeared. Horowitz agonized over the issue of Jewish ethnic identity in his later years. After he had become a conservative, Horowitz, his second thought was what he founded, and that was big, you know, in the, when, in the 80s? 80s, I guess, late 80s, 90s? 90s, I would say. Second thoughts, these former radicals become neoconservatives, essentially. Horowitz agonized over the issue of Jewish ethnic identity in his later years. After he had become a conservative, Horowitz decided to force the ethnicity issue when he was invited to take part in a symposium organized by those who still held on to the revolutionary faith. Just out of curiosity, Horowitz asked his former colleagues on the left, "I'd like to hear how the other Marxists in the room identify themselves ethnically." Horowitz goes on to add, "I knew, of course, that they were all Jews, and that not one would demean himself to acknowledge that fact. Rather than admit there was, in fact, a connection between being a Jew and being a revolutionary, Horowitz's colleagues dismissed his interrogations as an attempt to obstruct the seminar with questions that didn't interest anyone. They want to keep it hidden that they're all Jews." By the time he arrived at Berkeley, Horowitz, taking his cue from Marx's analysis of Jews as economic exploiters in On the Jewish Question, had concluded that ethnicity in general, and Jewish ethnicity in particular, was a problem which only socialism could solve. Socialism, Horowitz continued, would solve the Jewish question by eliminating Judaism, along with all the other ethnic and national identities. As a result, Horowitz wrote, quote, "I did not identify myself as a Jew. I was a revolutionary and an internationalist. To see myself as a Jew, a member of a real community and all its human limits, with all its human faults, to identify with the claims of such a community would have been a betrayal of the revolutionary idea." Even if that were the case, Horowitz was still forced to grapple with the connection between Jews and revolution and the fact that, quote, "For nearly 200 years, Jews have played a disproportionate role as leaders of the modern revolutionary movements in Europe and the West." In dealing with the Jewish inclination toward revolution, Horowitz is forced to deal with the Jewish religion. But here, as before, revolution becomes the central event around which everything else revolves. The central religious paradigm for Jews of the radical left is exile. As the Jews' exile from the land of Israel became more and more permanent, an apocalyptic strain of Jewish messianism developed, quote, "which no longer conceives the event as a restoration of the good of a previous time. Instead, Jewish messianism presents the longing for return in a metaphysical or theological light, according to which Jews have been sent into exile so that they can redeem the world or bring about tikkun olam." Spilled light, bring it back and put it in the bowl. This strain can most easily be seen in the Lurianic Kabbalah, where it appeared in explicit form for the first time in Jewish history in the aftermath of the Jews' expulsion from Spain in 1492. Jewish exile, according to this new view, was neither an unfortunate accident nor a punishment for having rejected the Messiah, but instead, quote, "a mark of our destiny to become agents of salvation." As the Kabbalist Chaim Vital put it, the Jews had to be scattered to the four winds in order to lift everything up. In their attempt to bring about tikkun olam, the Jews became the first revolutionary internationalists. Socialism and communism accepted these deeply internalized Jewish principles and secularized them to make more congruent with the intellectual standards of the 19th century, but messianic politics retained its religious roots nonetheless. Quote, "By carrying the revolution to its conclusion, socialists would usher in a millennium and fulfill the messianic prophecies of the pre-Enlightenment religions that modern ideas had discredited. Through this revolution, the lost unity of mankind would be restored, social harmony would be reestablished, paradise regained. It would be tikkun olam, a repair of the world." It is this paradigm, according to Horowitz, which forges the false bonds between Jewish faith and revolutionary fervor. By the time he wrote those words, Horowitz had concluded that, quote, the Marxist idea to which I had devoted my entire intellectual life and work was false. As a result, he concluded, I am nothing. When Horowitz lost faith in socialism, that event precipitated an identity crisis similar to the one Lorraine Hansberry described in the sign in Sidney Brustein's window. If Jews stop being revolutionaries, both Hansberry and Horowitz begin to wonder in their separate ways, do they have any identity? Horowitz grew up in Sunnyside, a section of New York in which being a Jew meant being a revolutionary, and vice versa. In Sunnyside, the rules of normal ethnicity prevailed, but they did not apply to Jews in the way they applied to other ethnic groups. The Jews never referred to themselves as communist. The common euphemism when Horowitz was growing up was progressive, which was a bland political category and not unlike a Jew taking a WASP name. Even if communists didn't believe in ethnicity, before long young Horowitz began to notice, however, that all the progressives had names like Abramson, Adler, Heller, and Wolfman, and that they, quote, were like a tiny scouting party that had infiltrated the camp of an alien tribe, vastly superior in number, who were neither intellectuals nor communists nor Jews. They were Irish and Italian. Their church was a pillar of the anti-communist cause. Their names were Bradshaw, Canarazzi, and O'Brien, and the institutions of their Catholic life were visible along Skillman Avenue, where the shops of the neighborhood were also arrayed. There were the stations of sin and redemption that marked their moral progress. The Shamrock Bar and Grill, the Amodeo Family Grocery, the storefront offices of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, St. Teresa's, and the Shea Funeral Home. Catholics were an especially virulent form of goyim, a prejudice which Horowitz's parents had confirmed in their minds when they read the books of Paul Blanchard. Quote, many of the existing governments in Eastern Europe were Catholic. Another book in my parents' shelf, The Vatican by Paul Blanchard, explained how the Catholic Church was in league with corrupt privilege and was the world's biggest landowner. The Catholic Church had rallied the reactionary forces in the Spanish Civil War and now was playing a similar role in Eastern Europe. When the communists seized the governments of Hungary, Cardinal Joseph Minzenti took refuge in the U.S. Embassy and made himself a symbol of anti-communist resistance. In America, Catholic politicians and clerics like Cardinal Francis Joseph Spellman and Bishop Fulton J. Sheen became leading spokesmen of the anti-communist cause. The inflammatory currents of the international civil war simmered in the Sunnyside air. In Sunnyside, ethnic animosity flowed, not from anti-Semitism, but from the fact that Horowitz's parents felt, quote, hostility toward the goyim, and indeed everything the goyim held dear, and that incited the hostility back. In spite of his efforts, however, Horowitz cannot solve the ethnic problem on its own terms. In order to answer the ethnic question, Horowitz has to probe deeper into areas that are personal, familial, and psychological. Horowitz claims, I do not really have an answer to the mystery of origins, to what in particular had set my father, and eventually therefore myself, on the radical path. But in mentioning his father, he proposes a psychological starting point for his quest into why so many Jews became revolutionaries. My father, Horowitz wrote, thought of himself as a revolutionary. Horowitz goes on to confirm the suspicions Lorraine Hansberry mooted in Brustein. Once the Jew ceases to be a revolutionary, he has no identity. When he writes, the Communist Party has become so much my father's personal salvation that without it, the possibilities of life itself vanish. By this point, Horowitz has reached the heart of the matter, which is religious and moral. His father is lost because he rejected the light, and as a result, he had become enclosed in his own darkness, where the only ray of light was his revolutionary fantasy, now reduced to a desperate personal quest. Irving Lewis Horowitz has an equally grim assessment of his own father, whom he describes as, quote, the perfect Sambardian man, the Calvinist Jew, convinced that the road to heaven involved good work and no nonsense. Horowitz's father was a bundle of contradictions right out of Marx's essay, Zur Judenfrage. He was a petty capitalist who had beat his son unmercifully for lifting a dime from his cash register, but he was an ardent socialist, and he identified socialism as the religion of the future. In the present, which is to say in Harlem in the 1930s, Horowitz's pair was in the wrong place at the wrong time, because, as his son puts it, Harlem was the wrong place for a Jewish Calvinist. Irving Horowitz got the impression from his father that he and his sister were an, quote, unwanted intrusion, mouths to feed, obligations, limitations on his movements, impediments. If that is the impression Horowitz got from his father, it is not surprising that he sums up life at home by saying that, quote, the central aspect of the Horowitz family was the absence of love. Family finished a distant third behind petty everyday capitalism, which involved cheating the Schwartzes when they brought in their Christmas bulbs for testing, and the revolutionary fantasies which made this sort of life tolerable. Like David Horowitz's father, Irving Horowitz's father lived in an imaginary world full of Jewish Bundism and Russian Bolshevism, a world which he characterizes as a religion without Christ, a church without crucifix. Revolution, in other words, was a fantasy which Jews conjured in their own minds to make the world without light or love tolerable. The Jews David Horowitz knew as a child were helpless to control the circumstances of their lives. As a result, they turned to the opium of revolutionary fantasy for solace. By the time he wrote those words, Horowitz had become a devout American patriot of the neoconservative persuasion, as Crystal Parrot Fills would joke. As a neoconservative, Horowitz was confronted, however, with his parents' hostility toward America. When they arrived at Ellis Island, the Jews had brought with them an ancestral hatred of Russia and the Tsar, but America was not Russia. If it ever seemed appropriate, revolution was a wildly inappropriate response to the welcome America had extended to Eastern European Jews, or just European Jews. David Horowitz feels that it is entirely possible that, quote, Jews were more accepted and felt more at home in America at that time than they had in the 2,000 years since the destruction of the Second Temple. If that is the case, then why had they chosen to become Bolsheviks in America? Why had Horowitz's family become permanent conspirators in a revolutionary drama in a land where the response was totally inappropriate? Instead of being grateful to a nation that had provided them with economic opportunity and refuge, they wanted to overthrow its governing institutions and replace them with a Soviet state. Why had the family, Horowitz family, proclaimed its allegiance to an ideology so alien to everything around them? The answer to these questions is because they were Jews. They had been trained to think about the Goyim in a particular way by their parents, who in turn had been instructed in the same way by their parents, all the way back to the rejection of light and love that took place at the foot of the cross, and sent the wandering Jew off on his revolutionary journey. But, Mr. Jones, that's incorrect, because they acted that way before Jesus was ever around. In a sense, Horowitz feels that he had no choice in the matter. He became a revolutionary Jew because he was raised to be a revolutionary Jew. Quote, "What was my own choice? In the beginning, I hardly had one. I understood early that my parents' political religion was really the center of their moral life. This meant, without their necessarily intending it, that the condition of their parental love was that I embraced their political faith." When David Horowitz arrived in Berkeley, it struck him as being, quote, a larger Sunnyside where the aliens were fewer in number and our tribe greater, the aliens being the Goyim. On arrival, I immediately became part of a group of red diaper babies, the designation we used to identify ourselves as children of the communist left. Scheer was another New York Jew who was part of the tribe at Berkeley. Scheer, according to Horowitz, had grown up in the Coops, a cooperative apartment complex in the Bronx, or maybe it was co-ops. Scheer had grown up in Coops, a cooperative apartment complex in the Bronx, which, like Sunnyside, had been colonized by the Communist Party. Unlike Comrade Jerome and his generation, Scheer was a beatnik and had the style of a political hipster, whose speech was salted with allusions to Charlie Mingus and Allen Ginsberg, along with Marx and Lenin. Ron Radosh, another Jewish revolutionary from the same era, described Scheer in his book Commies as a sexual revolutionary who felt the Kim Il-sung regime in North Korea had created heaven on earth. Scheer felt this way about North Korea, according to Radosh, because it eventually offered political sanctuary to Eldridge Cleaver, whom Radosh refers to as Scheer's protege. Scheer and Horowitz came from a new generation of revolutionary Jews who were more American and less Russian, as well as more cultural and less economic in their orientation. Speaking for himself and the Jews of his generation in America, Horowitz claims that, quote, It was exciting to hear the Marxist categories revived by someone who affected the style of the Beats, was at home in the popular culture. The old left had a snobbish disdain for mainstream entertainments, which it viewed as corrupt expressions of commodity capitalism. Scheer connected the political failure of the old left to its ghetto mentality. To hear him speak of a coming revolution in images that were not those of a marginalized subculture was exciting. America and communism were made for each other in a way because both taught contempt for ethnicity and roots. Given this fact, the Jew is the ideal cultural intermediary because he had internalized the principles of what Stalin referred to as, quote, rootless cosmopolitanism for centuries. Quote here, the revolutionary belongs to a community of faith that extends beyond the classes and the nations and reaches across the boundaries that divide and oppress. Within every nation group, it forms the basis of a new human community and a new human identity. Today, the revolutionary is isolated, obstructed by the divisions that form the cultural and political legacy of the past. The revolutionary is of the nations, but not in them. For the revolutionary's eye is on the future. Today, there is black and Jew, American and Russian, Israeli and Arab, but within each nation, Russia, America, Israel, Egypt, there were the aliens, the persecuted, the unassimilated, the quote-unquote Jews, who know the heart of the stranger and who join for human freedom. Today they are separate, tomorrow they will be joined. Horowitz says that Rampart's promotion of the Black Panther Party as the new vanguard of the black struggle was, quote, another source of Rampart's growing influence. The opposite was, of course, just as true. Even if the Panthers increased Rampart's circulation and influence, it was Rampart's which created the Black Panthers, because it was Scheer who, in Horowitz's words, became perhaps the key person to launch the career of Eldridge Cleaver. Eldridge Cleaver spent the Civil Rights Revolution in Soledad Prison, where he was serving 1 to 14 years for assault with intent to murder. With his left-wing lawyer-slash-mistress Beverly Axelrod as his intermediary, Cleaver made contact with Rampart's, which then began to receive letters from him on a regular basis. It was out of these letters that Scheer would fashion the first Rampart's articles and then the book Soul on Ice. In his first Rampart's piece, Notes on a Native Son, which appeared in the magazine's June 1966 issue, that's the month I was born, Cleaver denounced James Baldwin and just about every other black writer as buck dancers who were worse than Uncle Tom's. Baldwin had become, quote, a white man in a black body, a self-willed automated slave. He becomes the white man's most valuable tool in oppressing other blacks. Conspicuous by its absence from Cleaver's critique of Baldwin was any mention of Commentary or any of the other Jewish magazines and organizations which had promoted Baldwin to the position of spokesman for his race in the first place. The absence is not surprising because the Jews at Rampart's were doing the same thing for the career of Eldridge Cleaver. Eventually, Soul on Ice would become one of Rampart's books' biggest selling titles. In Cleaver, America had discovered a true black, which is to say an amoral criminal and rapist. He talks about raping white women in that book, Soul on Ice. He was a good writer, though. which is to say, so the Jews are producing all these black revolutionaries and celebrating them and printing their letters, even if they're writing from prison, in which they're talking about how much they liked raping white women, among other stupid things. In Cleaver, America had discovered a, quote, true black, which is to say an amoral criminal and a rapist who could rationalize his crimes by appealing to the writings of French existentialists. In spite of the adulation which the literary establishment heaped on Cleaver, it didn't take a genius to see that, in Soul and Ice, the old pattern which Harold Cruse and Lorraine Hansberry had complained about in figures as diverse as George Gershwin and Norman Mailer had reasserted itself. Once again, the Jews got to define the Negro as a criminal and a sexual deviant. In the case of Soul on Ice, the true black expressed his true identity by raping white women. It was as if Scheer and the staff at Rampart's were determined to prove that the South's interpretation of the Scottsboro Boys trial had been right all along. The New York Jews, now transplanted to Berkeley, California, were stirring up the Negroes again. How else was one to interpret passages like the following? I became a rapist. To refine my technique and modus operandi, I started out by practicing on black girls in the ghetto, where dark and vicious deeds appear not as aberrations or deviations from the norm, but as part of the efficiency of the evil of the day. And when I considered myself smooth enough, I crossed the tracks and sought out white prey. There are, of course, many young blacks out there right now who are slitting white throats and raping the white girl. The prose could have been lifted directly from Scottsboro, the firebrand of communism. The only difference was that Haywood Patterson never used the words like modus operandi. The fact that a Negro who had spent the last few years of his life in Soledad Prison did use phrases like that made Cleaver sound a lot like Ruby Bates when she told the crowd in Washington that she had lied under oath because, quote, I was afraid of the southern white ruling class people. Suspicions about just who had written the book deepened when Cleaver continued in the same vein, decrying the, quote, slaughter of Jews by Germans and the dropping of atomic bombs in the Japanese people as, quote, deeds which weigh heavily on the prostrate souls and tumultuous consciences of the white youth. Skepticism about whether Cleaver had actually written Soul and Ice surfaced shortly after the book was written when a black student in Tom Wolfe's book, Radical Chic and Mau Mauing the Flat Catchers, announced, quote, that book wasn't written for the ghettos. It was written for the white middle class. They published it and they read it. What is this, quote, having previously dabbled in the themes and writings of Rousseau, Thomas Paine, and Voltaire, unquote, that he's laying down there? You trying to come down at Fillmore doing some previously dabbled in talking about Albert Camus and James Baldwin? They'd laugh you off the block. That book was written to give a thrill to white women in Palo Alto and Marin County. That book is the best suburban jive I ever heard. I don't think he even wrote it. Eldridge Cleaver wouldn't write something like that. I think his wife wrote it. Don't privy-davel the people with no split-level Palo Alto white bourgeois housewife Buick estate wagon backseat rape fantasies. In discussing how Soul and Ice became one of Rampart's bestsellers, Horowitz admits that, quote, the nihilistic view of himself that Cleaver promoted in his book fits snugly into the radical outlook of the magazine. Horowitz also admits that he was the author of at least one article which appeared in Rampart's under Cleaver's name. Horowitz says that Scheer asked him to, quote, take charge of an article Eldridge Cleaver had written on the land question when he was arrested for shooting an Oakland policeman. Horowitz also adverts to something that other readers had noticed as well, namely that Cleaver's rape fantasies sounded a lot like Norman Mailer's essay, The White Negro. This similarity in outlook came about either because great minds always moved in the same circles, or because, quote, in a seminal article titled The White Negro, Norman Mailer had cast America's blacks as Rousseau's noble savages, representatives of humanity in its pristine state. These were the oppressed of the radical imagination. The Panthers' roots in the ghetto were the primal symbol of social injustice. Their will to violence was the mark of their revolutionary spirit. It is entirely possible that Cleaver read Norman Mailer's essay, The White Negro, while in prison. Since David Horowitz admits to writing at least one of the articles which appeared under Cleaver's name in Ramparts, it is just as likely that Mailer's White Negro made it into Cleaver's writing via the editorial ministrations of Horowitz or Scheer. Either way, Cleaver's image of the Negro rapist came from the mind of Norman Mailer. Whatever the source of the rape material, Eldridge Cleaver was a Jewish creation, and the Black Panthers were a Jewish fantasy of revolutionary Negro sexual deviance in the tradition of Haywood Patterson and Porgy and Bess. As the movement continued on its revolutionary trajectory, the fantasy continued, but its imagery became more violent. Robert Scheer, who also volunteered to edit or ghostwrite Cleaver's second book, changed the title from Cleaver's original How I Fell in Love with the Black Panther Party to Courage to Kill, as if to show that the Panthers were the vanguard which would bring about the eruption through violence of messianic redemption into history. It was an old story by 1968, but it had never lost its attraction to Jewish revolutionaries. Like Scheer, Saul Stern was another Jewish editor at Ramparts. As if to lend further credence to the idea that the Panthers were a Jewish creation, Stern wrote an article on the Panthers which appeared in the Sunday magazine section of the New York Times in August 1967, and it was that article which turned the Black Panthers into a household name. Because it appeared in the Times, Stern's article lent, quote, an authority that Ramparts could not have provided to the messianic Jewish fantasy that the Black Panthers would bring about tikkun olam by murdering white policemen. Stern, and you'll see the parallels to now, where Jew Soros funds Black Lives Matters and Jew media cover up for them by claiming they're not involved when they are shooting policemen. Stern lent credibility to Newton by cloaking his ranting in the language of the Holocaust. Every time you go to execute a white racist Gestapo cop, Stern has Newton saying, you are defending yourself. If Times readers missed the point, Stern was ready to give the Neo-Black Jewish Alliance interpretation of Newton's words by writing, to these young men, the execution of a police officer would be as natural and justifiable as the execution of a German soldier by a member of the French Resistance. So, according to Stern's redaction of Newton, all cops were Germans, which is to say Nazis, which is to say expendable in the cause of revolutionary violence, which the Negroes would carry out per the instructions of their Jewish handlers, Flax, and ghostwriters. Horowitz not only agreed with Stern's take on Newton and the Panthers, he was offended when Joan Didion disagreed in her article on the Panthers in Look magazine and denigrated Newton, quote, as little more than a young hood who had added Marx to his hustler's bag of tricks. When Horowitz laid the responsibility for the coming race war at Didion's feet, she shot back, I thought radicals wanted a race war. During the summer of 1967, riots in Detroit and elsewhere gave the impression that the race war had finally arrived. H. Rapp Brown, new head of the SNCC, was arrested in Alexandria, Virginia, and charged with inciting a riot and arson. Brown's arrest, however, could not disguise the fact that by the summer of 1967, the Black Panthers had succeeded SNCC as the cutting edge of black revolutionary politics in the United States. 2 months after Stern's article appeared in the New York Times, Newton was arrested for shooting an Oakland police officer in the back at close range. The officer's name was John Fry, anglicized version of Fry, F-R-E-I, F-R-E-Y, the name, indicated that he was of German extraction. The same media machinery which orchestrated the killing now went into high gear to exonerate the killer. Pictures of Huey Newton wearing a black beret and seated in his rattan chair with a spear in one hand and a rifle in the other began to appear on the walls of the counterculture's apartments across the nation, and Eldridge Cleaver, with financing from wealthy Jewish backers like Bert Schneider, mounted the Free Huey campaign. Cleaver turned to lawyer Charles Gary and his team of Jewish lawyers, who in turn launched a disinformation campaign among an all-too-compliant press, claiming that Newton was the victim of a frame-up at the hands of a government that was determined to destroy the Black Panther Party by killing off its members in a series of ambushes. Before long, Newton had become a national icon, and a new overtly revolutionary Black Jewish Alliance was pressing forward with its plans for race war and violent revolution. In the Bay Area, that meant a merger of the Peace and Freedom Party, people like Scheer, Michael Lerner, later editor of Tikkun, Tom Hayden, who had been raised a Catholic in Michigan, Jerry Rubin and Joe Bloom, who had attended Merritt College with Newton. In February 1968, both sides closed the deal. The PFP accepted the Panthers' 10-point program, and Cleaver accepted their nomination as PFP's president, with Jerry Rubin as his running mate. As part of his platform, Cleaver endorsed Pussy Power and any group willing to assassinate policemen. When 6,000 people gathered at Oakland Auditorium to celebrate Newton's birthday and protest his arrest for the murder of Officer Fry, H. Rapp Brown brought the crowd to its feet by announcing that, quote, Huey Newton is our only living revolutionary in this country today. Not to be outdone by Brown, former SNCC chairman James Foreman told the crowd, quote, we must serve notice on our oppressors that we as a people are not going to be frightened by the attempted assassination of our leaders. For my assassination, and I am now low man in the totem pole, I want 30 police stations blown up, one southern governor, two mayors, and 500 cops dead. And if Huey Newton is not set free and dies, the sky is the limit. The crowd responded by chanting, the revolution has come, off the pig, time to pick up the gun, off the pig. Martin Luther King was assassinated on April 4th, 1968. The long-awaited revolution arrived 2 days later when Cleaver ordered an armed attack on the Oakland police force. Four carloads of armed blacks set out to ambush a police car on April 6th. When the police found them instead and attempted to pull them over, a gun battle ensued. As a result of the attack, Bobby Hutton, co-founder of the Panthers, ended up dead, and Eldridge Cleaver ended up back in jail. As it had in the case with Newton, the neo-black Jewish alliance quickly came to Cleaver's defense, claiming that he was the victim of an assassination attempt followed by a frame-up. In an open letter published in the New York Times, James Baldwin, O.C. Davis, Elizabeth Hardwick, Leroy Jones, Oscar Lewis, Norman Mailer, Floyd McKissick, and Susan Sontag opined that, quote, "We find little fundamental difference between the assassin's bullet which killed Dr. King on April 4 and the police barrage which killed Bobby James Hutton 2 days later. Both were acts of racism." In May, Cleaver's wife, so there's a very long history of Jews justifying blacks attacking whites. And when whites do something legal or defend themselves, the Jews are always there to claim that basically anything a black does to a white is justified in the name of revolution. We are racists and oppressors of blacks, so anything they do is justified. This is why you can't have, one reason of many, that you can't allow Jews to live among you. Despite what Jones is saying, it's a racial characteristic since it's always been with them and is identifiably with them before this sci-fi character called Jeebus is even supposed to have existed. In May, Cleaver's wife and Bobby Seale set out for New York City to raise money for Cleaver's Legal Defense Fund, where they were greeted as real revolutionaries. As Tom Wolfe said after witnessing the Panthers' attempt to raise money in Leonard Bernstein's posh apartment, "The very idea of them, these real revolutionaries who actually put their lives in the line, runs through Lenny's duplex like a rogue hormone." Eventually, all of the money that got raised at Lenny's duplex was forfeited when Cleaver jumped bail and left the country. For the next few years, reports of Cleaver in Korea, Scheer's heaven on earth, Algeria, and France, filtered back to America as the movement he inspired turned to more and more suicidal forms of violence and eventually burned itself out by the mid-70s. But in 1968, Eldridge's words resonated throughout the community of the left and inspired white radicals further along the road to revolutionary authenticity and violence. In the summer of 1970, Faye Stender, the radical Jewish lawyer who had spent Freedom Summer of 1964 in Mississippi, was now a member of Charles Gary's legal staff, succeeded in persuading the appellate court to overturn Newton's conviction for manslaughter. When Newton emerged from prison on August 5th, 1970, thousands of his admirers were there to greet him as if he were God, as if to show that he agreed with the crowd, that he was at least a god of the sort that the Greeks admired. Newton took off his shirt and flexed his muscles, and the crowd went wild. Turning on to 962. Stender's brief cited the racial polarization in the Bay Area and claimed that that polarized atmosphere, along with the heavy publicity surrounding the Newton's case, had made a fair trial impossible. No one mentioned it at the time, but Stender's argument was one more version of Lewis Marshall's Supreme Court appeal in the Leo Frank case. The euphoria surrounding the release of Huey Newton obscured the fact that the Jewish legal tradition, which extended from Lewis Marshall to Faye Stender, had created a legal argument that would return to haunt the Jews who invented it. In setting Panthers like Newton free, Stender had created a monster that would quite literally return to destroyer. Johnny Cochran would use a variation of the same argument in the trial of fellow Panther Geronimo Pratt and, more famously, in the trial of O.J. Simpson, in which Cochran turned the tables on the prosecution and focused the nation's attention on whether Officer Mark Furman was a racist and not whether O.J. Simpson, like a latter-day Eldridge Cleaver, slit the throat of the white woman who happened to be his wife. Oblivious to his own role in promoting black men slitting the throats of white women, Horowitz accused Cochran of playing the race card. "Why hasn't justice prevailed in this matter?" Horowitz fumed. "Why is a clearly guilty individual free?" The answer lies in the climate of the times, in which the testimonies of officers of the law have become more readily impeachable than the testimony of criminals. If Cochran's brief was an attack on law enforcement as a racist conspiracy to get his client, Horowitz failed to see in that strategy the legacy of the Leo Frank case and Soul on Ice. The chickens, as Malcolm X had said when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, had come home to roost. Horowitz criticized, quote, the radical left and the left liberal media for elevating the rudest, most outlaw element of a black America as the true keepers of the flame and all it means to be black, forgetting for the moment his own role in promoting Soul on Ice. Horowitz then brought up the publicity campaign surrounding the release of Monster, the autobiography of L.A. gangbanger Cody Scott. Monster, according to Horowitz, was promoted in a way frighteningly similar to the way Eldridge Cleaver was introduced to the public in the late 1960s. The cultural DNA which enabled Jews in the publishing industry to promote sexually liberated criminals as the true black had begun with the Harlem Renaissance in the 1920s, and it was still alive in the 90s. Block quote. What white journalist William Broyles, who facilitated the publication of Scott's book, is analogous to journalist Bob Scheer, who in 1966 was a facilitator of Eldridge Cleaver's career. Atlantic Monthly Press, publisher of Scott's book, is analogous to Rampart's Books, publisher of Cleaver's Soul on Ice, just as Cleaver's book was touted by Maxwell Geismar of Rampart's as, quote, a document of prime importance for an understanding of the outcast black American soul today. Morgan Entrekin of the Atlantic Monthly Press has said that Scott, as a result of his memoir, is a, quote, primary voice of the black experience. Scott was also written about by Leon Bing, white former fashion model who in 1991 wrote a book about black gangs called Do or Die. Bing, a woman, could be analogous to that other facilitator of Cleaver's career, Beverly Axelrod. All of this was true, of course, but missing from all the indignation surrounding Horowitz's account was an admission that he had anything to do with promoting, quote, the rape fantasies which were given direct voice in Cleaver's Soul on Ice. Shortly before he died, Eldridge Cleaver was interviewed on 60 Minutes. The author of Soul on Ice had passed through a number of incarnations since returning to the U.S. to face trial for his role in the uprising of 1968. He had been a Mormon, a born-again Christian, and author of a revisionist born-again autobiography titled Soul on Fire, and even a Republican. But now the chastened revolutionary could only say that the United States had treated him and his fellow blacks decently, even if he didn't feel that way when the media was promoting him or because the media was promoting him. Cleaver was now glad that more people hadn't taken him seriously back then because, quote, if people had listened to Huey Newton and me in the 60s, there would have been a Holocaust in this country. Horowitz cites the interview but again maintains his innocence. There is no recognition of his responsibility for promoting Cleaver as the black rapist revolutionary, nor is there any recognition of the fact that Cleaver talked the way he did because he had been coached by Jewish revolutionaries like Norman Mailer, David Horowitz, and Robert Scheer. After his release from prison, Newton embarked upon a life of wretched excess involving tumblers of cognac, taking assorted pills, and most of all snorting cocaine, which eventually led to his death. The beautiful people from New York and Hollywood offered him drugs, alcohol, and women to fulfill his wildest dreams and heavy appetites. One of the beautiful people who picked up the tab was Bert Schneider, who had become the Jacob Schiff of the black revolutionary movement of the 1960s. Schneider, who was the son of Abraham Schneider, a top executive with Columbia Pictures, had made a name for himself as the producer of Easy Rider, the 1969 countercultural biker epic, and creator of The Monkees, a television series about a rock band. Schneider had put up $300,000 just to finance two conferences. He wore one of the gold rings Newton gave to his inner circle, and was so free with his money because he genuinely loved Huey P. Newton. Newton returned to Schneider's love by subjecting him and his girlfriend at the time, Candace Bergen, to cocaine-fueled diatribes that lasted into the wee small hours in the morning. In 1971, Horowitz and Collier succeeded in ousting Hinkle and Scheer from the board and took over Rampart's magazine. In retrospect, it was a bit like staging a mutiny on the Titanic. By the early 70s, it had become clear to Horowitz that the movement had flamed out. It had been killed by President Richard Nixon, who killed it by ending the draft. Once that happened, the anti-war demonstrations stopped and the protesters disappeared. And hardcore revolutionaries like David Horowitz were left high and dry. I felt, Horowitz said later, a need to do something to fill the void. Ramparts, in the meantime, had become a void that needed to be filled. Now that the movement had flamed out, Ramparts was chronically short of funds. That meant person-to-person fundraising, and one of the donors high on the list of every revolutionary organization in California was Bert Schneider. When Collier and Horowitz met with Bert Schneider to ask for money, Schneider, who had sided with Newton in the Cleaver-Newton power struggle over who was going to control the Black Panthers, suggested that they meet with Newton. He accompanied his suggestion with a $5,000 contribution and a request that Ramparts do an article on the Panthers' new school and survival programs. Following Schneider up on his suggestion, Collier and Horowitz met with Newton at his Lake Merritt penthouse, also provided by Schneider's contributions. Expecting a confrontation, Horowitz was taken aback when Newton asked to come work for the Panthers' new school. Horowitz later remembered Newton making a dramatic announcement to the effect that the time had come to put away the gun. It was now time to serve the people. Instead, a suggestion which Horowitz, who was looking for something else to do now that the anti-war movement had flamed out, found sensible. And so after the meeting, Horowitz offered to help Huey with the party's community projects and to raise money for the Panther School. Before long, Horowitz had raised more than $100,000 to buy a building for the Learning Center, which was instructing more than 100 children under the guidance of Herbert Cole. With respectability and the money that went with it, Horowitz soon realized the Panthers were in need of a bookkeeper. At this point, Horowitz asked a woman by the name of Betty Van Patter to serve as the Panthers' accountant. Van Patter, like Stender and Axelrod, was part of the Revolutionary Ladies Auxiliary in the Bay Area. She was good at numbers and enjoyed sleeping with black men. In December of 1974, she was hanging out at a local bar when she received a note asking her to meet someone and left the bar. Van Patter never came back. Betty Van Patter, Mudshark, accountant to the Black Radicals. 1 month later, her body washed up in the eastern shore of San Francisco Bay, and an autopsy showed that she had died when a blunt instrument had caved in her head. By the time she died, Horowitz had already abandoned the Panthers after one of their young members had been shot at a school dance. Horowitz had left the Panthers because, quote, underneath all the political rhetoric and social uplift, I suddenly realized was the stark reality of the gang. I remember a voice silently beating my head as I sat there during the service, tears streaming down my face. What are you doing here, David? It screamed at me. It was my turn to flee. When he fled, Horowitz forgot to tell Van Patter about the stark reality of the gang, and now Van Patter was dead, and David was feeling guilty. Instead of dealing with the guilt directly and assessing his own responsibility, Horowitz once again took refuge in the claim that he was an American innocent and didn't really know what was going on. Horowitz, for example, didn't know that Newton was a drug addict, in spite of the fact that Newton had a perennially running nose and Herbert Cole was telling people that Huey was using cocaine. In another account, this time of Newton's all-night harangues at Bert Schneider's, Horowitz says that it was only years later when he realized that it was cocaine that fueled these marathons, but at the time I was innocent of the drug and marveled at his stamina. The same refrain gets repeated over and over in his memoirs. Horowitz portrays himself as a latter-day Daisy Miller. He was an American innocent. Horowitz claimed that he bridled when Scheer referred to him as Little Davy Horowitz, but goes on to add, Scheer's ascription of innocence to me was not wholly off the mark. At another point, Horowitz claims that his guilelessness made me impervious to many of the undercurrents in the office and caused me to misinterpret others. One of the undercurrents Horowitz missed was the fact that the Panthers were stockpiling weapons and planned to use those weapons. Horowitz missed this, even though by the time he joined the Black Panthers Party, both Huey Newton and Eldridge Cleaver had been arrested for murdering policemen. After describing Captain Franco's revolutionary philosophy, Horowitz adds, in time I began to see the dark reality of the revolution according to Franco, the revolution that was not some mystical battle of glory in some distant land or time. At the deepest level there was blood, nothing but blood, unsanitized by political polemic. That was where Franco worked, in the vanguard of the vanguard. The Panthers were a criminal army at war with society and its thin blue line of civic protectors. That is certainly a movingly accurate account, but the careful reader is forced to wonder why Horowitz didn't come to this understanding before 1974, when he could have warned Betty Van Patter. When one of his colleagues held Horowitz responsible for her death, Horowitz flew into a rage, but the questions about his innocence and responsibility remain, even if he didn't set her up. Like Claude Rains in Casablanca, Horowitz was shocked when he found out that the Panthers had stockpiled, quote, literally thousands of weapons. Is Horowitz the only person who didn't know the Panthers were violent? Hadn't he seen all those photos of them carrying guns? Everyone else in America had. Horowitz gets closer to the heart of the issue when he writes that the left, quote, in creating a protective shield around the Panthers, unquote, was merely following the example of Trotsky, who had described the communist parties of the world as frontier guards for the Soviet Union. A more apt example could have been taken from the Black Jewish Alliance. The Jews had tried for decades to turn Negroes into revolutionaries because, one, they could then use them to fight the revolution by remote control, and two, because the white reactionaries focused all their attention on blacks when in terms of revolution they were the symptom and not the cause. Well worth remembering, well worth quoting. By the time Betty Van Patter's body washed up on the shore of San Francisco Bay, the revolution had degenerated into the random acts of violence and criminality that characterize the black ghetto today. The Jews had half succeeded in turning the Negroes into revolutionaries, which meant that they destroyed their faith, corrupted their morals, and turned them into halfway house to revolution, which Marx described as the lumpen proletariat, which is another word for criminal, or pimp. The one thing Huey Newton and Eldridge Cleaver shared with their epigony of the 90s and beyond was a desire to live off of women. After Cleaver left the country, his faction, the Black Panthers, became known as the Black Liberation Army, and their efforts at revolution ended in total disaster, but not before a number of people, mostly from warring factions of the Black Panthers, died. One of those victims was Sandra Pratt, wife of Geronimo Pratt, who was tortured, shot, and killed by the Newton faction Panthers, a fact which caused Newton to apologize eventually to her husband. Newton himself ended up being killed by a drug dealer after having spent his final years in Oakland high on crack, ranting about how he was, quote, the leader of the coming revolution. When one of his former colleagues claimed that Horowitz was responsible for Betty's death, he reacted with rage. Quote, no radical leader, Horowitz writes, proposed any second thoughts about a gang they had anointed as their revolutionary vanguard, nor did any radical critics. The silence of the left would endure throughout the life of the generation. The deflection of responsibility here is not just personal, although it is certainly that. By constantly referring to the left, the left-wing media, etc., how it is that my former comrades on the left can remain so stubbornly devoted to experiments that have failed, to doctrines that are false, and to causes that are demonstrably wrong-headed and even evil, Horowitz deflects attention from the role that the revolutionary Jew played in the racial catastrophe which followed the 60s revolutions in America. In this, Horowitz is a lot like James Baldwin, who could never quite bring himself to admit that the white people he wrote about in Harlem were in reality Jews. Harold Cruse is still the only writer to face up to this fact unflinchingly. That makes Harold Cruse an important writer for our political understanding purposes. Harold Cruse, C-R-U-S-E. In May 1980, Faye Stender committed suicide in Hong Kong. Stender had also defended Black Panther George Jackson and had edited his prison papers into a book and had fallen in love with him and become his mistress as well. The Jackson story, however, didn't end as happily, at least in the short run, as the Newton story did. On August 7, 1970, 2 days after Newton's triumphal emergence from prison as a result of Stender's brief overturning his sentence, Jonathan Jackson, George's brother, took a number of people hostage, including Judge Harold Haley, all of whom were killed when they tried to drive away from the courthouse. George Jackson was gunned down on August 21, 1971, during an escape attempt 3 days before he was to go on trial. 7 years later, a member of Jackson's prison gang broke into Stender's apartment and, in attempting to kill her, succeeded only in paralyzing her from the waist down. Disillusioned with the course of Black Revolution, which she helped orchestrate, Stender had become a feminist over the course of the 1970s, and at the time of the attack was living with her lesbian lover. Faye Stender, unlike Horowitz, had been a missionary to the Black Revolutionary cause. Unlike Horowitz, she, quote, hid Jackson's dark side from the public by excising from the pages of his manuscript the passages that revealed it. For her pains, the monster she created had returned to destroy her. When the Black Frankenstein she had created failed in his mission, Stender could finish off the job herself by committing suicide. In a line that could have come from feminist-inspired horror film like Alien, Horowitz writes that Stender fled to Hong Kong because the far end of the world was the only place she could feel safe from further retribution. But like Dr. Mobius in Forbidden Planet, Stender learned that there was no geographical escape from monsters of the id. Stender was killed by the revolutionary spirit which she had nurtured within herself through all of its various incarnations. Freedom Summer in 1964. The Black Panthers in the late 60s. Feminism and lesbianism in the 70s. And a Masada-like suicide in 1980. Faye Stender had to learn that the revolution devours its own Jews the hard way. The Jews created Black Frankenstein, who in turn returned to destroy them. Faye Stender's death by her own hand brings us back to the question of Jewish identity. Stender's identification of her Jewishness with revolution was so complete that when it became apparent that all of her revolutionary options had failed, she had no identity left and had to kill herself. David Horowitz, another missionary to the Black revolutionary cause, came to a similar conclusion. After concluding that Marxism was an illusion, David Horowitz embarked upon a life of promiscuity and nihilism that almost led to his own death, as well as in a half-intentional automobile accident. After an affair with one of the Rockefeller siblings wrecked his marriage, Horowitz concluded that, quote, "There was no revolution of attitudes or institutions that could overcome the forces of this nature. Through the deaths of Betty and Ellen, through the pain of my divorce, I had acquired a certain philosophical fatalism." Taking his cue from what he had said about his father, Horowitz indicates that a Jew without revolution is a Jew without an identity. Craving absolution but unable to find it among his former colleagues on the left, Horowitz concludes in the wake of Betty Van Patten's death that there is no Messiah because the revolution failed to materialize. Quote, "Betty's death killed this fantasy in me. There was no revolutionary community. There would be no redemptive future. There was no one to save us from who we are." The moment was short-lived, however, because Horowitz soon converted to yet another version of Jewish messianic politics, this time neoconservatism. Unable to stifle the desire to be a commissar, Horowitz began a new career by attacking professors who criticized Israel or contested the details of the attack on the World Trade Towers, urging students to inform on their professors in a gesture that recalled all the worst aspects of the Soviet regime. During the fall of 2007, Horowitz traveled from one campus to another, trying to drum up support for an attack, with nuclear weapons if necessary, on Iran. And he just kind of ends it there. On 968. I mean, that, it's really, it's not racial. You really don't think it's just a racial thing, huh? I think Jones does believe it's a racial thing, and I think he's just not willing to admit that. And that he's like these Jews, isn't he? He's admitting that we are the problem. And his Catholic beliefs are preventing, his Catholic ideology is preventing E. Michael Jones from seeing what his data and his historical examples are screaming at him for thousands of years. Anyway, fantastic stuff, tracing the relation between the Jews and the violent Black left, and their essentially production values being behind it, just as they were with NAACP back in the 1910s. And so we're getting there. We got a couple more chapters and the epilogue to go. Or three more, I guess. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you real soon, and we'll do chapter 30.